As well as the work in Lodge, Freemasonry has a social side. Organized Freemasonry developed in a great age of sociability and conviviality, and the customs of the day were incorporated into Masonic usages. As we have seen, the Premier Grand Lodge itself was originally formed in 1717 as a means for the members of the four London lodges to come together socially for the enjoyment of a grand feast. The convivial side was equally as important as the business of electing a Grand Master and Grand Wardens. The Grand Festival has become perhaps more decorous, but still remains the high point of the Masonic year. There are those who have criticized the social side of Freemasonry, but in an institution which has brotherly love as one of its basic principles, and the promotion of fellowship as one of its aims, a great deal would be lost if Freemasonry was limited to the proceedings carried out within the lodge room. The first Grand Festivals were held in taverns, but with the election of the Duke of Montague as Grand Master in 1721, the annual assembly and feast began to be held in the hall of one of the great livery companies of the City of London, and continued to be held there until the first Freemasons' Hall in London was completed in 1776. The event was a very public one. The brethren all met at the townhouse of the incoming noble Grand Master, and a procession, preceded and followed by bands of musicians, was formed to march from there to the hall at which the festival was to take place. The brethren would march two by two, dressed in their aprons and jewels, and carrying the emblems, symbols, and banners of the craft, followed by the nobility in their carriages and chariots. Not surprisingly, such processions attracted public attention, and in the 1730s they were caricatured in the press, and an order of scald miserable masons began to hold processions a few days before the Grand Lodge procession, resulting in the latter being abandoned in April 1747, and a regulation being made that in future no public processions of masons clothed in the badges of the order could be held without a dispensation. Once the procession arrived at the hall, a Grand Lodge was opened, and the election of the new Grand Master was confirmed, after which the Grand Lodge was adjourned to dinner, and the public healths were drunk. After dinner, the new Grand Master was installed and invested his Grand Officers, who would then pass around the hall for the new Grand Master to be proclaimed. This was followed by the general or regular healths, which ended the formal proceedings. The evening would end with orations, music, and Mason songs until the Grand Master formally closed the Grand Lodge. Various brethren had offered themselves as stewards as early as 1721 to assist the Grand Wardens in preparing for the feast, but in 1728 a significant development took place. Dr. Desaguliers proposed that 12 stewards should be appointed to have the management of the feast, the birth of the Grand Stewards. The 12 stewards were allowed to nominate their successors and were so successful in carrying out their duties that in 1731 they were given the privilege of having their own jewel of office and of lining and edging their aprons with red silk. A further privilege was added in 1735 when they were allowed to form a lodge whose membership was, and still is, limited to those who have served as Grand Stewards. The Grand Stewards continued to nominate their successors until the union of the two Grand Lodges in 1813, after which the appointments became more formalised. The Duke of Sussex selected 18 London Lodges, many of which had provided Grand Stewards before 1813, to annually nominate from amongst their members a Grand Steward for appointment by the Grand Master. Pilgrim Lodge number 238 gave up its right in 1834 and was succeeded by Jerusalem Lodge number 197. The Old King's Arms Lodge number 28 lost its right on a technicality in 1852 and was replaced by Old Union Lodge number 46, but was restored to its privilege in 1904, so that there are now 19 lodges with the privilege of nominating a Grand Steward. To be a Grand Steward is a highly prized honour, but it is also an expensive one, as the Grand Stewards originally bore the whole cost of the festival. They were allowed to charge a nominal dining fee, made more realistic this century, but the Grand Stewards have to cover any shortfall between the sum raised by the dining ticket and the actual cost of the festival. After the union, the assembly became formalized into the annual investiture, at which the Grand Master was installed and appointed his officers, for which Grand Lodge was opened and closed, whilst the festival was separated off as a formal dinner without any Masonic ceremonial. Up to the outbreak of war in 1914, ladies were invited to the Grand Festival. It's not clear if they attended the dinner, but they certainly joined with the brethren at its conclusion to hear a concert of vocal and orchestral music and to join in the singing of part songs and glees. Since 1914, the Grand Festival has been a purely Masonic affair at which the Grand Stewards entertain the Grand Master, the Grand Officers and personal guests. Less fortunate than the Grand Stewards was an 18th century group known as the Country Stewards. In these days of Greater London and urban sprawl, it's difficult to remember that in the 18th century, Islington, Hampstead, Vauxhall, Ranelagh and Gunnersbury were little country villages separated from the cities of London and Westminster. In the early 1730s, it was decided to hold a summer or country feast to honour the Deputy Grand Master at a suitable tavern in one of the villages around London. As with the Grand Feast, it was soon realised that stewards were required to organise the event, resulting in the creation of country stewards. Like the Grand Stewards, each year's Board of Country Stewards was given the right to nominate its successor, and they were granted a special jewel to be worn suspended around the neck from green ribbon. In 1789, they successfully petitioned to have their own lodge, restricted to current and past country stewards, and to match their status with that of the Grand Stewards, the Country Stewards petitioned the Premier Grand Lodge in 1792 for the right to line and edge their aprons with green silk. Whether it was jealousy on the part of the Grand Stewards, or the intemperate manner in which the petition was presented, uproar ensued in Grand Lodge when the matter was debated and the petition was rejected, leading to the Country Stewards present storming out and declaring that if they could not have the green apron, they might as well lose their special jewel and lodge. Tempers were allowed time to cool before the next Grand Lodge, at which the jewel and lodge were restored, though the green apron was still refused. The hierarchy of Grand Lodge continued to be disturbed by the Country Stewards pressing their claim, resulting in the Deputy Grand Master, Admiral Sir Peter Parker, stating in 1794 that as he was to be abroad on naval duties, the country fee should be suspended until he could attend in person. Incredibly obstinate, the Country Stewards in 1795 sent to the Grand Secretary a list of stewards for that year and tickets for the feast to be distributed to the Grand Officers. Rather brusquely, the Grand Secretary returned the list and tickets, stating that there could be no feast or stewards as the Deputy Grand Master had suspended the occasion till he could preside in person. Nevertheless, they went ahead, held the feast, and forfeited any support they might have had. No further official country feast was held, therefore no further country stewards could be appointed. The Country Stewards Lodge continued to attend the Grand Lodge until 1799, when they disappeared forever, their lodge warrant being used in 1802 to form what is now the Royal Lodge of Faith and Friendship, number 270, at Barclay in Gloucestershire. As a fellowship or brotherhood, the social side of Freemasonry is almost as important as the principles and tenets which are taught in the formalised setting of the meeting. Indeed, it would be true to say that in its earliest days, Freemasonry was very little different from the many other tavern and coffee house societies which were so popular in England in the early 18th century. Since the great changes in ritual brought about by the union of the two Grand Lodges, there has been such a total separation of lodge meeting and festive board that it is often forgotten that originally there was no distinction between them. 18th century lodges, met in private rooms in taverns or coffee houses, with most of the evening being spent seated around a trestle table, at which the administrative business of the lodge would be carried out and the catechetical lectures worked. Average attendance at a lodge meeting would be between 20 and 30. In addition to the emblems of masonry, the table would carry clay pipes and tobacco jars, bowls of fruit and nuts, bottles of wine, port and brandy, bowls of punch and mead, and jugs of ale. The alcohol was not simply there for refreshment, however, for the catechetical lectures were divided into sections, between each of which a formal toast would be drunk, often accompanied by a song. At a convenient point, the Masonic work would cease, and the landlord, often himself a Mason, would bring in supper. Any unfinished business would then be dealt with, the lodge formally closed, and the evening rounded off with the singing of part songs and glees. With this consumption of refreshment and singing of songs, it's not surprising that lodge minutes of the period often ended with a statement to the effect that the lodge was closed with feelings of true harmony and brotherhood. 18th-century lodge treasurers, being mindful of the charity and refreshment funds, were not slow to introduce fines for any misdemeanours. Fines of anything from tuppence to a shilling, not inconsiderable sums when the average wage of a tradesman was about £1, were levied for non-attendance at lodge, for arriving late, for falling asleep whilst the lodge was engaged in solemn business, a not unusual occurrence when meeting and refreshment were combined, for being disguised in drink, as they termed overindulgence, for escapes in modesty of language, as they termed swearing, for being improperly dressed, for refusing to take office in the lodge, and for smoking in lodge. After the ritual changes agreed by Grand Lodge in 1816, the conduct of lodge meetings was radically altered. The meeting became more formal and required a lodge room, from which food, alcohol, and tobacco were banned. The social side of fellowship also became formalised into what is now called the festive board. Originally, this was a simple supper, during which loyal and Masonic toasts were honoured, but it developed into what seemed to us to have been gargantuan festivities. Surviving menus from the late Victorian and Edwardian periods list enormous banquets of 8 to 12 courses, each offering as many as a half dozen choices and accompanied by its own wines, the whole being finished off with coffee, decanters of port and brandy, liqueurs and fine Havana cigars. Dinner was often accompanied by music from a small military or string band, and the formal toasting would be interspersed with vocal, instrumental or comical entertainments. The oft-repeated comment by the late Arthur Askey and many of his contemporaries that they owed their early experience and popularity to working at weddings, bar mitzvahs and Masonics has a great deal of truth to it. The First World War and its resultant social changes had their effect on the festive board, which gradually returned to what it was over 150 years ago, a formal dinner of 3 or 4 courses during which the members of the lodge and their guests can enjoy each other's company, followed by formal toasting. Music played an important part in Masonic proceedings. A wealth of Masonic songs have survived from the 18th century. Almost every Masonic publication of that time included a selection of Masonic songs, usually giving only the words to them. The earliest songs appeared in Anderson's 1723 constitutions. From the mid-18th century, lodge minutes begin to record the purchasing or hiring of organs to assist in the music-making, but many of the songbooks only include the melody with accompaniment of flute or recorder. Some lodges even initiated musicians as serving brethren. That is, they were made Masons but not members of the lodge to provide music at their meetings. The Somerset House Lodge, Now the Royal Somerset House in Inverness Lodge No. 4 had a strong musical tradition in the late 18th century, and their music collection included concertos for harpsichord and string players, Masonic songs, and collections of popular songs of the day. The Premier Grand Lodge had purchased an organ shortly after its hall was completed, but it was not until after the Union that a grand organist was appointed to provide music at Grand Lodge meetings. The first grand organist was Samuel Wesley, and amongst his successors were many noted organists and composers of the day, including Sir Michael Costa, Sir Arthur Sullivan, Lionel Monckton, Sir Landon Ronald, Sidney Scott, and Henry Gosse Custard. Whilst the Masonic press reports that they delighted the assembled brethren with their performance on the organ, none of the grand organists appears to have composed any special music for Masonic occasions, unlike their more renowned brethren, Mozart and Sibelius. Today, the organist at Masonic meetings, at whatever level, simply provides accompaniment for the opening and closing odes and suitable background music at appropriate points during the ceremonies. In 1916, the Board of General Purposes had considered the questions of the use of instrumental and vocal music in lodges as a result of complaints that items were being used which could give offence because they were easily identifiable with a particular religion. As a result, Grand Lodge agreed a ruling barring the use of such instrumental or vocal music. The matter came under consideration again in 1963, when Grand Lodge was considering the whole question of the relationship between Freemasonry and religion. On the 13th of March 1963, the following policy statement was adopted as a Grand Lodge regulation to be obeyed by every lodge. Instrumental or vocal music is not per se objectionable during Masonic meetings, but care must be taken that vocal music is such that it is not identified exclusively with a particular form of divine worship, and that it does not offend the susceptibilities of a particular creed, since Masonry is open to the adherence of every faith which requires belief in a supreme being, and that all other musical items should be scrutinized with the same care as any spoken additions. The ladies have had their part to play in the social side of Freemasonry. They were invited to take part in the dedication of the new Freemasons' Hall in 1776, being present at the beginning of the meeting for the formal handing over of the building by the architects and the hall committee. They also took tea and cakes and listened to a boys' choir whilst the Masonic ceremonial took place, returning to hear the speeches and a concert. Throughout the 18th century, an anniversary ball was held to commemorate the dedication, and concerts, poetry readings, theatrical performances, and soirees were regularly held in the hall. As we have already seen, throughout the 19th century, ladies attended the Grand Festival, and they were, and still are, guests at the anniversary festivals of the three great Masonic charities. At lodge level, we find evidence from various parts of the country in the 1790s of ladies being invited to dine with the lodge once a year. In the provinces in the 19th century, a lodge or group of lodges in a particular area would join together to hold an annual ball, at which, by dispensation, regalia would be worn. By the 1870s, Masonic balls had become very popular, and music still exists for Masonic waltzes, gallops, and the Lancers. By the end of the 19th century, ladies' dinners and Masonic balls had begun to merge into what are now known as ladies' festivals. Many lodges now hold an annual dinner dance for their ladies, their families, and non-Masonic friends. In many small provincial Masonic halls, the ladies are involved in the life of the lodge by planning and carrying out the catering for lodge meetings, something which might not perhaps please the feminists, but is done voluntarily by those concerned who enjoy joining in with the fellowship of their menfolk. Throughout the 18th and 19th centuries, there was a long tradition of Grand Lodge and individual lodges giving theatrical performances, both in London and the provinces. The brethren would arrange to fill the theatre for a particular performance and would attend in their regalia. The performance would usually begin and end with specially written prologues and epilogues, which were often afterwards printed for sale, the proceeds being added to the theatre receipts to swell the charity funds. The performance would either be for the general charity fund or a benefit for a specific person or cause. Many playbills survive for Masonic bespeaks, usually decorated with Masonic symbols, and show a wide variety of performances from grand opera to potted Shakespeare, melodrama and farces, excerpts from well-known plays of the day, and what we would call variety programmes and circus acts. Although the public procession held as part of the Grand Feast had been stopped in 1747, such processions were still permitted, though they could only be held by special dispensation. Often, they were for purely Masonic purposes. Provincial newspapers in the 18th and 19th centuries regularly carried reports of public processions by local lodgers, often going from the lodge room to attend divine service. More impressive were the public processions, again usually to church, held during a provincial Grand Lodge meeting. In addition to the provincial grand officers and representatives of the lodges in the provinces, all in their regalia and with their banners, the procession would include the town band and that of the local militia, the town council in their civic robes, and the local clergy in their vestments. As well as their own processions, lodges would also take part, in regalia, in processions as part of local or national celebrations. One public custom, often including a procession, which has now ceased, is the laying of the foundation stone of civic or religious buildings, bridges, and monuments. This was regularly done with Masonic ceremonial up to the 1930s, since when it has died out of use except in the case of new Masonic buildings. The inhabitants of Holborn and Covent Garden turned out in force in 1808 to see the then Prince of Wales, later King George IV, lead a Masonic procession from Freemasons Hall to Bow Street, where, in the presence of over 1,000 spectators, he laid the foundation stone of the Covent Garden Theatre, a predecessor of the present Royal Opera House. His brother, the Duke of Sussex, probably set some form of record for laying foundation stones, usually in his capacity as Grand Master, of hospitals, public buildings, and bridges as far north as Newcastle-upon-Tyne and as far west as Bristol. His record must have been almost matched by that of his great-nephew, the Prince of Wales, later King Edward VII, who laid foundation stones with Masonic ceremonial not only at home, but on his travels abroad. What is believed to have been the largest ever Masonic gathering, for a purely social reason, was held on the 8th of August 1925 at Olympia in London. It was a festival as part of the fundraising to provide money for the building of the present Freemasons' Hall. Over 7,000 brethren, presided over by the Grand Master, the Duke of Connaught, accompanied by the then Prince of Wales, later Duke of Windsor, the Duke of York, later King George VI, and Prince Arthur of Connaught, sat down to a lunch at 5 miles of tables served by 1,300 waitresses. Over lunch, they consumed 600 pairs of best end of lamb, 3,000 pounds of salmon, 1,500 chickens, and 250 gallons of ice cream. During the course of the lunch, it was announced that £826,014, 11 shillings and sixpence, had been promised to the fund. Whether in lodge or at refreshment, the craft Freemason soon learns that there are other branches of Freemasonry to which he can aspire. Preeminent is the Royal Arch, but that is a lengthy story requiring a chapter of its own.